Going beyond the headlines to the deeper issues. 96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight Segment, where your questions and comments matter at 202-319-7810. Join the conversation.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight Segment. I'm Harold Fisher.
This opioid crisis is a crisis. I see it every day. It's as bad as they say. It's ruining lives. It's destroying families. Sadly, you know what it reminds me of? Seeing it? Reminds me of us. These white folks look exactly like us during the crack epidemic. It's wild because I even have insight into how the white community must have felt watching the black community go through the scourge of crack. Because I don't care either. Hang in there, whites. Just say no. What's so hard about that? Remember when y'all said that to us? But it's okay. There's no grudges. Now you finally got it right. Once it started happening to your kids, you realize it's a health crisis. These people are sick. They are not criminals. They are sick.
That is comedian Dave Chappelle in his latest stand-up effort, talking about the opioid crisis. But drug abuse and recovery are no laughing matter. And as difficult as recovery is, it can be done. Well, tonight, as we recognize National Recovery Month, we talk about overcoming serious substance abuse addictions. My guests are Sandra Crew, Howard University Dean of Social Work, Dr. Janice Davis, Howard University Director of Clinical Education, Horace Anding, addiction counselor and recovering drug and alcohol abuser, and Abdul Carbo. He is a certified addiction counselor. Lots to talk about tonight as we delve into this very serious subject. Lines are open. Give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. And we encourage you to call tonight, particularly if you or someone you love has a problem with substance abuse. We have help here. I want to thank you all for coming in to talk about this. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Good to be here.
Okay. So, first of all, I want to talk to you about your stories briefly. How did you get involved with drugs and alcohol? What was your drug of choice?
Mr. Fisher, my drug of choice at the end was crack cocaine. I was sharing with the ladies earlier in the lobby how I'm a survivor of the crack epidemic of the 80s. I've been drug and alcohol crime free now 30 years, only by the grace of God. Started off with a little bit of marijuana. Due to some issues in my life early on, I look back on it now, I know it was some painful events. Increased to alcohol, increased to a little bit of PCP. At 17, I was snorting cocaine. And at 18, I tried a drug, crack cocaine, to change my life forever. And I looked up, and I was 28 years old and 97 pounds. I had absolutely nothing but a bunch of problems, legal problems, housing problems, financial problems, relationship problems, family problems, parenting problems. I was a problem. Mm. And a friend of mine put me in the detox down on the grounds of D.C. General here in our nation's capital. I went to a 30-day program from there in Montgomery County, and one day at a time for the past 30 years, I have not drank any alcohol or drugs. And it's not been easy. Recovery is a lifetime commitment, a lifetime job. I've overcome a lot of obstacles. I've worked in this professional field now for the last 28 years of treatment between Maryland and D.C., I love what I do. It's not just a job for me. It's like a calling on my life. And I believe that when people address the real pain from their life through counseling and therapy and spiritual development and spiritual guidance, along with the support from a family or your family members and support from the community, your life, not only will your life change, but your lifestyle will change.
You said you've been clean for 30 years, and you mentioned that a friend put you in a treatment program. Was that difficult to accept the fact that you needed help? Why didn't you do it on your own?
You know, that's a good question. It was very difficult because I knew I had a drug problem. I did not know I had an alcohol problem until I got out of treatment and went to some Alcoholic Anonymous meetings. I had a friend of mine, because I was in complete denial about my alcoholism. I had a friend tell me, he said, I want you to go to some AA meetings for about 30 straight days and just sit up front. Mm. And that's what I did. And I sat there, maybe about the 15th, 16th meeting I went to, I heard a guy tell my story from alcohol, and I never knew this person. I was like, wow, I'm an alcoholic, and I have to accept this, and I have to do something about this so that I won't go back to the life that I live.
Abdul, when you listen to what Horace is saying, you know, he spoke, you know, specifically about crack cocaine. We heard Dave Chappelle talk about it, and we don't need a comedian to let us know that the country is in crisis when it comes to opioid abuse. Is this the same old problem with just a new drug, in your opinion, or new drugs?
The short answer is, first of all, I want to say greetings to my my former professor and mentor from the Howard University School of Social Work. I just graduated this year. So
congratulations,
Dr. Davis and Dr. Crew. I think when we talk about addiction as a social problem, it goes back, you know, centuries, as long as we've had this industrial community. So the short answer is yes. I think that as you see people's life circumstances get worse, speaking, of course, in terms of unemployment, economic instability, just not knowing what the future holds, stress is one of the major triggers. And everything that the gentleman said just prior, you know, I was really intrigued because he spoke about all the other problems that were going on in his life with his social relationships, family relationships, his state of mind beyond just the substance. And that's sort of what I've observed, that the substance abuse and the substance use disorder that it produces are really the tip of the iceberg, and there's always a lot more problems underneath.
We're talking about recovering from substance abuse, drugs, alcohol, and the difficult but not impossible road to recovery. We will be taking your phone calls tonight at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Dr. Davis, why is recovery so difficult?
Good evening. Recovery is difficult primarily because there is no one set way to get there. We tend to look at life as a very linear path, and recovery for each individual is based on that individual. So what works for one individual may not work for someone else. And so you have to be in the position and mindset to say that recovery is personal, it is intentional, but it is based solely on the individual who is actually undergoing the process.
Are some people more susceptible to relapses than others?
I think everyone is susceptible to relapse. It depends on what your support system looks like, as well as what has made you decide that you are now sick and tired of being sick and tired.
And let me help for those who may not be familiar. What is a relapse, Andrew?
Well, relapse is when you make a decision that you're not going to be on the drug of choice, but then you make another decision that you really are going to go back on the substance again. So that, you know, you really, you know, become clean for a moment and you're feeling good about that, but something happens and then you return back to the use of the substance. Mm-hmm. So that's what we talk about as a relapse, that you're on the path for it. And some trigger happens.
You're nodding your head, Horace.
Very true. She hit it right on the head. A lot of people get clean for a while, a long time, 1, 2, 3, 4 months, 5, 10 years. I recently ran across a longtime friend of mine who told me that his sister relapsed after having 32 years sober. That's a long time, Harold, for a person to relapse, but it's even harder for that person to come back from, because now you're dealing with a tremendous amount of guilt, shame, embarrassment, humiliation, degradation. It's just a lot that goes into that. You just feel worthless, hopeless. But I would tell anybody that if you have breath in your body and you have any type of faith in God, you can make it. You can really make it. People are recovering and recovering well. Mm-hmm. Not just staying sober, but living well. They're living different. I've had people tell me, man, you don't even look like you ever used to do drugs before, you know.
And what does that look like?
Yeah, what does that look like? You know, you can't describe addiction when a person is in recovery, very healthy and motivated and faithful, and most importantly, their belief and their faith in God. I strongly believe that that's been the foundation for me that has helped me sustain the 30 years that I have, because I know it's only by the grace of God that I'm here.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Tonight we are talking about recovering from substance abuse, drugs, and alcohol. If you have a comment, if you have a question, if you need help, give us a call. Help is here in studio and on the phone. Let's go to T. T, thanks for calling from Maryland. What's on your mind?
Hi, I just wanted to congratulate all of those who have recovered and still are recovering. But myself, I have 29 years of recovery, and I have to tell you that it was not easy. And I think the thing that kept me out there the most was having enablers in my life. I would, you know, steal the money. I would steal everything out of the house, and then I would just get a slap on the wrist and was allowed to repeat the same action again. I never blamed my family for me staying out as long as I did, but I was on crack, I was on heroin, I was on PCP. But I do say that today I have a different outlook on not enabling people. You can help people without enabling them. But I thank God for the rooms of NA. I thank God for counselors and you know, mothers and halfway houses that push me through. But it really is, it's a mental, spiritual, and physical thing in order to recover. Okay. And it's something that you have to work on daily.
Well, Dee, thank you so much. I appreciate it. You were going to say something, Sandra.
Yeah, I was going to say, certainly, T, congratulations for your success. And you talked about recovery not being easy. But also addiction isn't easy. So we have to think about where is the greater good going to be served, and that, you know, if one can really think about how life will be better once they really free themselves from the addiction, then that is a much easier journey in many ways than to be continuously addicted, because you lose family, you lose friends, and most of all, you lose self. You know, self is lost in that whole process. So I think, you know, for those who have really gone down the, are going down the road of recovery, because it's never past tense. Mm-hmm. You're always mm-hmm. in recovery once there. So I think we have to think about that. And that when I think about the crisis of today, we also have to think about what's needed. And I think, as I've talked to Horace, and we talked about this, treatment on demand.
What does that mean?
Meaning that, you know, when you get the sense that I want to end my dependence, there ought to be a place that you can go and get treatment. And it's not something, and I know Horace can speak to this, that you can give me 24 hours to think about it. When I am really ready to make that decision, it is so important that we have resources and family, and not those enablers who are saying, oh, you can wait until next week. We have to be able to advocate for treatment on demand, meaning that when I'm ready, the system has to be ready to help me through this.
Yeah. Real quick, because I've got to go to a break. But Abdul, talk to me very briefly about what could cause someone to relapse after a year, 5 years, 10 years, 30 years.
I think it's often a question of stress. There's really one of two answers that I get. Sometimes people say, "Well, I got bored." In other words, they sort of fell into a routine. They lost sight of their recovery goals. And others, it's stress, sometimes a death in the family, loss of a job, a lot of those sort of like things that we have no control over that happen in our lives. And for someone who's been in the past, has developed a habit of using a substance to make themselves feel better, because that's really what substance abuse is at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult. It's almost like if you had a button or a lever that you could pull or push that you always knew was going to make you feel better. It's not going to fix your life. It's not going to give you a job. It's not going to make your partner come back or bring your loved one back to life. But what it will do is it cuts you off from those painful emotions.
I need to take a break. But when we come back, I want to drill down a little bit more, not only more about the difficulty of recovery, but also what you can do if you are struggling right now or know someone who is. And by the way, information about any kind of help that you may need will be posted on our website on WHUR.com after 8:30, as well as this podcast. So please stay with us. Vanessa calling from Bowie, Neil calling from Temple Hills. We will be talking to you next. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM, channel 141. Jeff Brown is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. This conversation continues on Sirius XM in just a few seconds.
The Howard University Radio Network is WHUR 96.3 FM, WHUR World 96.3 HD2, student-run WHBC HD3, GlassHouseRadio.com, SiriusXM Channel 142, HBCU, and SiriusXM Channel 141, HUR Voices, Washington.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We are recognizing National Recovery Month and talking about overcoming serious substance addictions. My guests are Sandra Crew, Howard University Dean of Social Work, Dr. Janice Davis, Howard University Director of Clinical Education, Horace Anding, Addiction Counselor and Recovering Drug and Alcohol Abuser, and Abdul Carbo. He is a Certified Addiction Counselor. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Neil, calling from Temple Hills. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind? Turn down your radio. Neil, are you there?
Yes.
Yeah, turn down your radio. What's on your mind, please?
Oh, I was just saying earlier, there's a variety of addicts, and we all come in different shapes, fashion, forms. Everybody doesn't lose everything and is not heartbroken when they come in here. I'm 28 years clean myself. And the key is wanting to and doing what somebody else tells you to do for a while. It frees you to do what you want to do. It's an oxymoron, a double-edged sword, for you to just get your a sponsor, go to meetings, and do what the sponsor tells you to do for a while. And what that does in turn, you become a new way of living, a new habit. You start to look at things differently. You're even willing to accept death. Good times, bad times, hard times, because they call that life, and it's going to happen, you know? Mm. And that was one of the things we choose to run away from, life.
Mm, interesting.
That's about it. That's all I got to say.
Neil, thank you so much. I appreciate that. What does he mean by life happens, Dr. Davis?
So for many of us, we have problems that occur every day. You have bills that you can't pay. You may have gotten sick. Your child may be sick. The way you cope with the problem is different. Wherein for people, this is life. This is part of what you're going to have to do. But for many people who want to avoid those responsibilities or avoid the feeling and the pain because it's uncomfortable, they go back to what's comfortable. And the drug allows an escape. It gives you time away from whatever is causing you some distress, and you continue to stay in that cycle. It's life. So life is never going to be calm, straight, easy, fun all the time. There will always be problems, and you have to figure out how you can overcome those problems.
But why is it that some people seem to be more susceptible to abusing these substances than others? You may have same neighborhood, and you may have a married father of four in a nice suburban house, and then you got another married father of four next door, same kind of house, happy life, but the guy on the right becomes addicted. The guy on the left does not.
Well, some has to do with your biochemical markers.
What do you mean
by
that?
Because you have some predispositions based on biochemistry and how your body metabolizes substances. So everybody metabolizes substances differently. So with that, some people would be more susceptible to being involved in being addicted to a substance or needing that substance more than someone else. You can have two individuals who consume the same amount of substances but do not have the same end result. So there are people who have used substances recreationally and have never become addicted to them. Mm-hmm. Where there are others who have used substances twice and they're addicted.
Mm-hmm. Abdul, you were saying something?
Oh, I was just going to add that absolutely that there is a biological component to it. The example I like to use in my groups is of just pigment, right? All of us, even as people of color, black and brown people, we're born with different skin tones and we therefore respond to sunlight in different ways. And for when it comes to addiction, which is essentially a disease of the brain, those differences are there. Not, of course, having anything to do with skin color. That's just an analogy. But it's that we all react differently. Our brain responds to our environment as well. So one thing that you see when you deal with a lot of people in recovery, and the other gentleman, the counselor, whose name, forgive me, I missed, mentioned it, hardship,
Horace.
Early
yeah.
life, mm-hmm. traumas. A lot of these are often linked. In other words, your lived experience, especially early in life, because one of the mistakes that I found in my own thinking when I started doing this work was thinking of the addicted person in front of me as recently becoming addicted. And that was partly to do with the way they told their stories. Their story was time they picked up. But there was, once you get to work with someone for a long time, you realize that a lot of things happen earlier in life, maybe in childhood, maybe in adolescence. Maybe there was some trauma, abuse, neglect, abandonment, some kind of emotional strain that made them, that affected their ability, in other words, to emotionally self-regulate. And that puts people in a very vulnerable state where the substance becomes sort of like an external emotional regulator, whereas what we want for people who are emotionally healthy is for them to be able to self-regulate internally.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Vanessa, calling from Bowie. Vanessa, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Oh, hi. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. Go right ahead.
I was waiting for the quiet storm to come on, and lo and behold, whose voice do I hear on the radio but my brother Horace? And he talked about his addiction, and I remember those days very vividly. And I was the hardliner person in the family, and I didn't put up with none of his crap. And
oh, dear. Vanessa, we are losing your signal. But we did get that last part about not putting up with Horace's crap, which is so important. Yes, indeed. Vanessa, thank you so much for sharing some insight about your brother.
Next question.
And as we, you know, it's funny. Because we kind of started this conversation with a laugh about a really serious issue, and I'm so glad that you can laugh about your crap.
Yeah,
but
it's good to laugh.
Yes, it is. But why is it? What is the first start to recovery? And I want to talk, first of all, from a clinical point of view, Sandra, when you have someone who is now dealing with an issue, does it matter what they're dealing with as to how they start, alcohol, opioids, or something else, or do they all kind of, do you start them off the same way?
I think addiction is addiction. And so when there's a dependency, you have to start with the dependency and whatever that is associated with. And as I was sort of listening to my colleagues here, I was thinking that often people who use substances, they think the use is the solution to their problem.
What do you mean?
Meaning that if they're going through a crisis in their marriage, they see the use as the solution to the problem, and when the use actually exacerbates the problem, it makes it worse. Yeah. So I think, you know, it's the lens that if I have this substance without regard to what the substance is, that's going to solve my problem, make my problem easier to bear. And it absolutely does the opposite. The other thing I was really thinking about, Horace and his sister, we can only laugh at it on the other side of through. Mm-hmm. Family members aren't laughing about it when they're going through the heartache and the headache and the pain of watching that person suffer.
Very true.
So the laughter can only come when you've seen the person get through this without regard to the source of the addiction. Then you can go back and really talk about some of the antics that they went through. But going through it, families are suffering along with the addicted. We have addicted families, basically, because they are really suffering right along with the person.
And that comes in with the enablers as well, because people don't want to see someone they love hurt.
What is an enabler?
An enabler is someone who allows you to continue in your addiction, and it may be done passively or very upfront. So you tell me I need $50. I just give it to you. Well, why do you need $50? You work every day. You've just gotten paid. Why am I giving you $50? We know it's because you're going to go get high. Mm. And so, but I'm going to give you the $50 because I don't want to see you in pain. I don't want to see you hurt. I don't want you to rob anybody, so I don't want to see you go to jail. So I'm going to give you the $50. I'm going to come home and you've stolen all my televisions out my house.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's you. I'm not going to call the cops because you're my child. I love you. So I continue to help you because I don't want to see you hurt. And so it gets a little ishy with people because I don't want to see you hurt. But sometimes, as his sister said, no, I took the hard line. So, you know, somebody has to be able to stand and not become sensitized to your hurt, because the reason you are using the substance is because you're hurting. Yeah. So we need to get to the hurt, and we can't get to the hurt by continuing to give you the substance.
Horace, what was the most difficult thing about recovery for you? Tell us about that.
Early on, there was a few different things, but early on was being patient with the process. I wanted everything to happen right away. I wanted a house. I wanted a job. I wanted a car. I want some money. I want some clothes. I want everything today. Recovery teaches you got to be patient. You didn't get into this overnight, and you're not going to get out of it overnight. And I heard somebody mention earlier about going to the meetings and counseling and therapy. I had to go through all of that, and it taught me how to be patient. I started off my first job in recovery, I was making $5 an hour. I was 28 years old with no benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And today I do a lot better than $5 an hour with plenty good benefits. And I have people who have helped me learn how to get things back in order, get my life in order, my budget, paying bills, being responsible, taking care of my kids. I became a grandfather this year, Harold.
Well, congratulations.
Three times over.
Wow.
My daughter just gave birth about a month ago to identical twin boys.
Oh, wow.
So I'm broke again and excited at the same time. So recovery, you got to come up with some more money for me. You know what I mean? And then my son, his girlfriend, she had a baby back in, a little girl back in April. So I have three grandkids in the last 5 or 6 months. So
you're going to need an extra knee.
I'm going to need an extra knee, yes, sir. Yeah, maybe HUR will give me a job here. I just think that out here.
I'm trying to keep mine. Yeah.
I need a good part-time job. Another good part-time job.
Abdul, is it more difficult, in your opinion, now with the kinds of drugs that we are seeing, you know, on the street, fentanyl and the other kinds of horrifically potent drugs?
Yes. I just, especially when it comes to the opiate drugs, I just saw an article today that in Western Pennsylvania, I think it's the Pittsburgh area, they have found this fentanyl. It's a fentanyl type of substance, but it does not respond to Narcan as well. Mm-hmm. Narcan is the medication that's used to reverse an overdose. So now there's a synthetic opioid out there that doesn't even respond to Narcan, and so it's harder to reverse the overdose. On the other side, the treatments are a lot better, and we know a lot more about the science and the biology of addiction, especially at the level of the brain. So the drugs are a lot stronger, but the field as a whole is a lot more robust as well in terms of the level of knowledge and techniques. You know, people now are talking more about therapy and counseling and trauma and PTSD and CBT treatments, whereas before there was only one treatment for substance abuse or chemical addiction: don't use, stop using. And now, you know, we're taking a more holistic approach. So I think even though the substances are more powerful, there is a lot of hope, because I think the treatments have also gotten a lot better.
You know, one of the things I'm really curious about, and this is for either Sandra or Dr. Davis, it doesn't matter. But, I was a teenager, and I was in college during the crack epidemic, and being a native Washingtonian and raised in the D.C. metro, I saw the impact of crack cocaine on black families. But this opioid crisis appears to be affecting white families more, which is not to say that black families are not impacted. Why is that?
Primarily because the substances were more made available in their neighborhoods. One of the things that occurred in our neighborhoods were that the doctors couldn't even write scripts for opioid medications. And our pharmacies, even the CVS, didn't have them in certain neighborhoods. You had to wait several days for them to get them. In most of your suburban neighborhoods, that was readily available. So prescription medication for opioids was readily available. Once they became addicted to the prescription drugs, then they went to look for street drugs to supplement that, because that was in the medicine cabinet at their house. But our houses weren't able to get that in the medicine cabinet. And our scripts were monitored much closer than what they were in the suburban communities.
Interesting. Abdul?
I was just agreeing with Dr. Davis. It's almost like in a sort of ironic, perverse way, anti-black racism worked in the favor of the black community, for once.
Interesting.
Well, I think, also... If there is anything that's good coming out of the opioid epidemic, is that perhaps some of the stigma is being removed, because it's no longer just about persons of color. And so getting treatment is not something that you have to hide. It's a good thing to get treatment. With behavioral health, it is no longer the huge stigma that it used to be. So I think that may have opened some doors for persons of color as well, although it may not have been the intentionality of that. But the unintended consequence is that I think we have a better understanding of addiction, and that it does impact all communities. So I think we've come a long way in not being judgmental of persons because they are not able to manage their life in a way without the substance. But I think the important thing is that if we can give people hope that you can overcome this, and I think Horace is an excellent example of this. And so when we have the opportunity to work with people as social workers and other certified counselors, we can say, there's a way out. And sometimes we spend a lot of time talking about how I got into the problem, and we have an opportunity now to talk about how you get out of it.
And to that point, Horace, what did the light at the end of the tunnel look like for you? You already spoke about going into treatment. You spoke about learning to be patient. But was there a watershed moment when you said to yourself, I can do this. What was that like?
It was, it took a little while, but it was a moment where I started going back to church. I hadn't been to church in a lot of years, and church was different when I went back. People were really into developing a real strong relationship with God, wanting to study and pray and meditate. And I began to gravitate to men and women who were serious about developing what we call a spiritual foundation. And I would go to Bible study. I would go on men's retreats. I would go on just different men's raps and settings and things of that nature. And it strengthened me because I was weak at the end. I remember just being in a dark place for a long time. And I was sharing with the ladies in the lobby before we came in how my last run was, I faced death, Harold. Death knocked on my door. I had a heart attack from smoking crack. And I just asked God, I don't want to die like this. Please don't let me die like this. And I went and got some help. And thankfully, through counseling and therapy and the faith and belief in God, and most importantly, the support of my family. My sister that you heard, it's real. I remember this is the same sister who shared with me, I would never come in her house ever again. Because she remembered when I used to go in and stuff would come out that I took. Mm-hmm. And when I go visit her now, it's like she don't want me to leave. You know what I mean? So that's different.
Wow.
Because she know I've made a lot of changes in my life. Of course, I'm not perfect. But I know this. Whoever is suffering from active addiction right now, you're listening at this broadcast, there's hope for you. If you are in recovery and you're struggling, you feel like you want to use, you feel like you want to give up, you got to dig deep now. This is a time to really dig deep because holiday season is coming up. And a lot of people that's in recovery become very vulnerable during the holiday season. Mm-hmm. So I always remind people to put a lot of real strong support around you starting right now because Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's is right around the corner.
Mm-hmm. Abdul, how do you know when you're counseling someone whether or not they're making progress or whether or not they're trying to pull the wool over your eyes?
I think that's a really great question. It's one I ask myself every day when I'm face-to-face with clients. You can, one of the ways, you know, I think it's different for each person, but one of the ways that I can tell is the way people talk about themselves. There's often people talk about themselves as having transformed, whereas a person who's just sort of faking the funk, they often talk about how, you know, maybe I do this or that. They may talk about external things, about the way, what they do, or they may talk about who they hang out with. But when a person is genuinely committed, and it's not just an addiction treatment, I think whether it's, you know, like exercise or weight loss program or even just health, maintaining your blood sugar if you're diabetic, there's a certain way that people talk about themselves as having changed versus what's going on around them. Because the truth is, we can only control ourselves. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the time, people who are externally focused are less able to work on their recovery because, of course, recovery, like the disease of addiction, begins and ends with us, the individual. So it's more of an internal process as opposed to an external process.
Sandra, how can the family members really help when perhaps that loved one who is addicted has been ostracized from the family?
You know, I think families are different, and there may be the sister that Horace had who is like, I'm not going to take this. But there may be also the other sister who can't turn her brother out. So we have to be able, as families, perhaps have family meetings to determine which person in the family is best to be the strong person. Because everyone can play that role in doing that. But how families can help, I think that's critically important, is understand that you do have to strengthen that spiritual muscle as well. So it's really important to give people options. Here are the options. And truth-telling. You have to be engaging in truth-telling. No, giving you this $50 may make me feel good, but what's going to happen to you if I do that? So I think when we look at families, we have to really look at them as different entities, because different people make up the families. But really thinking about who's the best spokesperson in the family, if we're going to have family therapy and looking at that. And then begin to think about, it is a family problem. It's not simply the problem of the addicted person. Mm-hmm. Just saying, you know, you have to leave, that doesn't always solve it with everyone. So that's we have painful. To really use everything in our toolbox to really help the person through. But we also have to celebrate successes and know that it's a long road. Mm-hmm. But being able to really support them and strengthen them and giving them encouragement and show them good examples that you can do this. We have to believe in the person.
Yes.
But the person has to first believe in themselves.
There you go.
That's interesting that you mentioned that. A friend of mine, this was this past spring, she mentioned to me, she told me that she was going to a birthday party for her father. And I said, oh, okay. Tell your dad, I said, happy birthday. But then when I spoke to her a week or so later, she said, you know, this wasn't your typical birthday. It was what he celebrated as a birthday was, I think, 25 years sober. And so he called that first day of sobriety a rebirth.
Yes.
But they had a party that had everything. It had, you know, they had, I didn't go, but you know, they had the food, they had the music and Kool-Aid. You know, and sodas, but you know, but no alcohol.
Yeah.
And you know, she said that was bigger than the real birthday. And I think, you know, that really puts a fine point on it.
Sure.
You know, particularly when Horace said that he was standing at death's door with that, you know, with that heart attack. I only have a few minutes left, but I want some final thoughts from each of you about this recovery process, particularly in this age of the modern opioid addiction. Dr. Davis.
Yes, I think what we have to be aware of is that we have new opportunities. We have multiple pathways to service individuals who want to recover from addiction. It's no longer just one set model. You don't have to just do a 12-step model. There are harm reduction models. There are other self-directed models that can be used. And if you want help, there's help out there. People are willing to work with you. And to help you, you just have to be willing to put yourself in the position to say, I need help and I need you to help me get there.
Abdul?
I think it's important to remember that substance use disorders are social disturbances as much as they are personal. And I know all of my colleagues have talked a lot about the power of a support system, and I think that is crucial. Life is hard enough as it is. Addiction, you know, it's hard enough for us to just live alone. Human beings are social animals. Addiction is not possible outside of a social context. Very few users abuse substances alone. There's usually a community of users and substance abusers in the same way that there has to be a community of recoverers, I should say, or people who support recovery.
Mm-hmm. Sandra?
We have to realize that social isolation is also a critical area to pay attention to. As we age in society and people are not connected to families, then that can really promote the use of substances. So we have to reach out to each other as community to let them know that they are important and they matter. And not only just look at people at the first stages of their life, but at the end stages of life too. As you're going through health challenges and others, be there for people. That's what we can do. And if you can see it, you can help them out of it.
Mm-hmm. Horace, I'll let you have the last word.
As we celebrate Recovery Month for September here, as we do every year, it's an exciting time, not just because it's Recovery Month, but a lot of people's lives are changing every day through the gift of living sober. And so I congratulate all of us who are in recovery. For those who are still addicted, a special message to you. There's a lot of help out here. I agree with all the colleagues here. Reach out to your local government, maybe it's a close friend, a family member. Go to a 12-step meeting, maybe your church or your mosque, your synagogue, whatever it is. But most of all, just give yourself a chance. Just really give yourself a chance because your life is worth it. Your family is worth it. But most of all, you're worth it. So recovery is possible for anybody that's seeking it.
Well, you know, congratulations, you know, to you, Horace, for sharing with us. And congratulations on all those grandbabies.
Appreciate it.
My goodness.
Yeah.
And in the words of your sister, no more crap.
No more crap.
That's going to be my new motto.
No more crap. No more crap. Sandra Crew, Dr. Janice Davis, Horace Anding, and Abdul Carbo, thank you all so much. And continue to keep up the good work.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Brother Abdul.
That is the Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 for this Wednesday, September 4th. I'm Harold Fisher. Now stay tuned for The Connection. Good night.